Are again. Memorial Day weekend. My name is Don Ecker. The subject is UFOs, and you're listening to the Cable Radio Network. And let me tell you what, we have a program tonight. One of the best known names in the UFO field for the last 40 years. A gentleman that has not only done radio broadcasts out of the Great Pyramid at Giza, he's trudged around the foothills in Tibet, around Mount Everest looking for impossible creatures, and he is a best-selling, best-known author worldwide. My guest's name is John Keel, and John, are you there?
Here we are, yes, indeed.
All righty, all the way back in New York City. Tonight we're going to be talking about some of Mr. Keel's adventures and also one of his best-known books, which recently have been re-released from Illuminet Press. And this is something that I can honestly say is one of the few books in my lifetime that I've read that even after I came back from Vietnam, it gave me trouble going to sleep at night. And the name of that book, The Mothman Prophecies. And we're going to be talking to Mr. Keel in just a minute. But first, we're going to take this break. And hey, look, don't only keep your eyes to the skies, but stay right here because there's going to be one fantastic show.
UFO Report. From the files of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, strange stories of strange things in our skies. This is Hal Starr with a report on unidentified flying objects, brought to you every day, Monday through Friday. In Elmwood, Wisconsin, lives 73-year-old George Wheeler, a highly respected police officer in that community with more than 30 years' experience, more than 30 years of a most respectable reputation. Last April 22nd, he was out on patrol in his police cruiser in this northern Wisconsin community when he radioed in at about 11 p.m. that he was heading for a rock quarry in the Pierce County community. He told the police radio dispatcher that it looked like a fire had broken out over there. Next, according to Police Chief Gene Helmer, Wheeler was heard to say over the police radio, quote, "My God, it's one of those UFOs again," unquote. He then calmly described what he was seeing over the police radio, but his description apparently was so similar to reports of other objects, there's little reason to go into detail. Oddly, though, the Elmwood police now seem unable to produce the transcript of that call. Anyway, after describing what he was seeing, the radio suddenly went dead, and Officer Wheeler could not be raised after numerous calls. A backup unit was immediately dispatched, and Wheeler was found sitting in his squad car in a semi-conscious state with the lights and ignition turned off. We'll tell you the rest of the story in just a moment, right after this important message. Elmwood, Wisconsin police officer George Wheeler was rushed to a hospital which could find nothing apparent wrong with him. He did spend some time in the hospital for observation, though, and later rested a few more days at home before returning to work. He had not been back at work very long before he again saw another UFO in the same general area, but this one apparently did not linger, and there were no after effects on Wheeler like the previous time. When questioned about what had happened, Officer Wheeler said that after he had given a reasonable amount of description of this saucer-shaped, glowing object hovering over a hilltop quarry south of town, he turned off his lights and motor to get a better view and to eliminate noise from his squad car so he could hear if there were any sound coming from this alien spaceship. It was at this point, says Wheeler, that something happened that sounds all too familiar to us. It sounds almost like a repeat of the Travis Walton affair because, at that instant, an extremely brilliant bluish light flashed out from the underside of this disc, hitting Wheeler squarely and knocking him out. And that's the last thing he remembers until the other police car showed up on the scene. Now, if you'd have asked George Wheeler several years ago if unidentified flying objects were real, he probably would have thought you were joking. But not anymore. Now he's convinced, not just because he's seen them twice himself, but because he had a pretty traumatic experience. Wheeler says, quote, "I am now convinced that UFOs exist, and the occupants of them are not harmless as some people think, but in fact, they are out to kill us." unquote. And that's UFO Report. Stories from the files of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization and brought to you every day, Monday through Friday. Until next time, this is Hal Starr, and keep an eye on the sky.
Okay, now some of the books that John Keel has written in his long and varied career include some bestsellers like Operation Trojan Horse. One of the more recent is a book called Disneyland of the Gods, and of course his all-time bestseller and one that he's most known for is The Mothman Prophecies. How are you doing tonight, John?
Well, we're having strange weather here in New York. I think there's a typhoon brewing.
A typhoon?
Or maybe it's a monsoon. Yes, indeed. The weather is doing its end.
Are you guys getting some rain back there?
We're getting rain tonight, yeah. And it was 82 this afternoon. It's 45 now. And the temperature is dropping very fast.
Well, I'll tell you what. We can't say that out here in sunny California. The weather's been gorgeous. John, looking at this newly released version of the Mothman Prophecies from Illuminet Press, and we're going to tell our listening audience how to contact those folks to get a copy of this book. Just the cover itself is absolutely startling. This was done by a gentleman that's known for some of his more unusual art, Franzetti. How in the world did you manage to...
Frank Franzetta.
Franzetta, right. How did you manage to get a hold of him to do this?
Well, Frank Frazetta has done the illustrations for a couple of my books. He claims that he's a Keel fan, and he did a cover for one of my books 20-some years ago. And he, of course, is probably the most famous of all the science fiction artists.
Yeah, he's known for some of his stuff in some of the Conan comic book magazines that have been around, too. He's done some really fantastic art in that.
Well, he does that kind of thing, and of course his calendars are everywhere now, and he's done all kinds of covers for all kinds of books and magazines, and now he's sort of semi-retired. I understand he plays a lot of golf now. He has a museum in the Pocono Mountains here in the East, and he sells his paintings as posters from that museum.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's my part of the country, and when I get back that way, which I think I may be later on this year, I'm going to try to look him up. Look, if you're in the 818-310 or 213 area code, make sure that you get a pencil and paper, because we're going to be talking about a contest a little bit later. Well, John, the subject of this show is UFOs tonight, and unless you've been living in a cave or just got back from Mars or Venus, I think everybody in the entire United States has seen the programming that has been on this past week on national television about the subject of UFOs. As a matter of fact, I was very fortunate to be the technical consultant on the Fox television show Sightings, which aired last Friday. And incidentally, we're gearing up for another episode to air in June. Now, of course, one of the things that you're most well known for is your UFO investigations that you were conducting back in the 60s, and some of those, I might add, would make any thriller seem tame by comparison, some of the things that happened to you. How in the world did you ever manage to get involved in anything like the UFO field?
Well, it was very easy. In the 1960s, UFOs were being seen all over the world almost continuously for 4 years, from 1964 till 1968. They were seeing them all over the Soviet Union, and the Russians in those days, of course, they were still communists, they were blaming the capitalists for it. They said it was all a capitalist plot. I still have somewhere in my debris here, I have an old TASS news report that blamed the United States for all of the UFO sightings and Tashkent in Russia. They were seeing them in Africa. You remember Idi Amin?
Oh, yes.
Well, he had his ambassador to the UN stand up and deliver a speech about the sightings in Uganda and demand that something be done about it. Of course, nothing ever was done about it. The UN didn't have the money or the inclination to do anything.
It sounds like Belgium in the last couple of years or more.
Yeah, the Belgium sightings were typical of the sightings that were going on all over the world at that time in the 60s. And here in the United States, you could go almost anywhere and see UFOs almost any time. Out on Long Island here in the East, they were seeing them with great frequency. And there were places, small towns in Georgia and Oklahoma, and places where they were seeing them every night of the week. And I traveled around the country, and I saw a great many of these things.
Well, let me read something here from the press release that Illuminet put out when they re-released your excellent book, and I can't stress that enough. The Mothman Prophecies occupies a place of honor on my bookshelf. And I'm quoting now. For 13 months, the entire town of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, was gripped by a dark terror that culminated in a tragedy that made headlines all over the world. This is a story that contains all the elements of a modern science fiction movie, but every single word is true, and fully documented by famed journalist John A. Keel. Homes throughout the town were plagued with unearthly noises and ghostly manifestations, while mysterious aerial lights traveled silently overhead, seemingly on a regular schedule. That's pretty heavy stuff, John.
And well, that's what was happening.
And you witnessed that, didn't you?
And it was getting a lot of publicity at that time. I was in West Virginia. I was south of the town of Point Pleasant in a town called Beckley, West Virginia. I was investigating the story of a winged cat when the Mothman story broke. A group of four young people were in an automobile in a rather isolated, gloomy, Lover's Lane type area outside of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, when they saw this creature that was larger than a large man, red, glowing red eyes, and wings. It had a 10-foot wingspan, and it chased their automobile out of the area. It was called the TNT area, because during the Second World War, there was a place there where they manufactured high explosives. Anyway, this creature chased these teenagers out of the area, and they were so terrified that they went to the local police. Now, you know that in a small town, it takes a lot to get teenagers to go to the local police and report anything.
Right.
And the police were so impressed with their sincerity and their fear that the police held a press conference the next day. And the story broke in newspapers all over the country.
Well, now, there were a lot of other elements that actually happened down there, some of them that were not known. The types of things happening were not known until much more recent times. But during that period of time, is it not true that there were also many animal mutilations down there?
Yeah.
And
I was one of the first to take an interest in that. At that time, the UFO buffs didn't want to hear about that. They thought that the animal mutilations had no relationship to the UFOs at all. And we were getting those up here in New York State, too. And when I went down to West Virginia, I found many of them down there, too. And they were really puzzling then, as they are now. And then later in the 70s, in the mid-1970s, they became a nationwide phenomenon.
Well, something else that would, perhaps not at first glance, but would seem to fit in there is the fact of the Red Cross Bloodmobile that had just been filled with fresh donated blood, and a UFO, according to what you said in your book, came down out of the sky and attempted to snatch this thing up?
Yes. The driver and the nurse were driving home. It was late at night. And this thing came down over the highway and chased the Bloodmobile, scared the daylights out of the two people in the Bloodmobile.
I'm still getting goose pimples thinking about that.
And suddenly traffic appeared from the other direction, and if the traffic hadn't appeared from the other direction, the thing might have picked the Bloodmobile up. The witnesses looked out their windows, and they said that some kind of arms were extended downwards from the flying object, as if it was going to grasp the Bloodmobile. And just at that time, the traffic appeared, and so the object withdrew. And they were terrified. They went to the local police, and they went on local radio and television. It was a major news story at that time.
Well, this is some pretty heavy-duty stuff. What did the local authorities have to say about that?
Well, in small communities, the local authorities try not to say anything about this sort of stuff. They try to just keep things calm, and that's what happened in West Virginia. The authorities did not try to take any kind of real position on it.
All right, you are listening to... You're listening to Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight on the Cable Radio Network. If you'd like to speak to my guest, John Keel, famed international author and UFO and 410 investigator, and you live in the 213-818 or 310 area code, you can... Okay, we're back. John, I'm sure that you probably saw the two-part miniseries this week, Intruders, which is based upon Bud Hopkins' book of the same name. However, back in the 60s, people did not know or acknowledge publicly things that would suggest a UFO-type abduction, but yet you were investigating cases very similar to that, weren't you?
One of my first magazine articles was titled UFO Abductions, and the UFO groups that existed at that time resisted this kind of thing altogether. They thought that anyone who reported any kind of amnesia or missing time was a hoaxer, a liar. And so these cases were suppressed in the 60s, not by the Air Force or the military or anything, but by the UFO buffs. There was a group called NICAP in Washington, D.C., that actually suppressed all of these stories. And it's only in recent years that Bud Hopkins and others have been bringing them out to light. But I encountered these right from the beginning in the 60s, many of them. And it was obvious that something very unusual was happening to the people. And I began to place the emphasis on the people. I knew we'd never catch a flying saucer, but I thought we should investigate the people more closely, that is, examine them more closely. Also, there were a great many physical injuries. There still are around the world, which go largely unnoticed.
When you say physical injury, what are you referring to?
They're very similar to the injuries you get in an atomic explosion. People who get too close to a UFO come down with leukemia almost immediately, often die from it. There are several cases of blindness from people. As you know, these lights are very bright. If you stare into these lights, they can blind you permanently. There are a number of cases of that. And there are many cases of burns, people being burned by these objects. So they're giving off a powerful radiation on all the frequencies. And of course, we know that on other frequencies, they're causing interruptions in the radios and television sets and causing automobile engines to stall. So whatever these things are, they're radiating a tremendous amount of energy.
Well, in a UFO magazine interview that I did with you several years ago, you had mentioned one of the large automobile manufacturing corporations that did a study on electromagnetic effects, didn't you?
It was Ford.
Ford Motor Company.
Yeah, the Ford Company did it in collaboration with Colorado University.
For the Condon Committee?
Yes. And they found that nothing that we know about could do it. That is, stall an automobile engine with magnetism. It had to be something else. It would take such a powerful magnetic field that it would actually do other harm to the frame of the engine. You know, it would bend metal and so on. And so it's obviously being done on a radio frequency rather than with just magnetism.
Was this specifically geared at seeing how a flying saucer or UFO could stop an automobile?
Yes, apparently the Colorado people, the Colorado University people, enlisted the Ford Motor Company to do tests of this sort. And it was not mentioned in the final report, but it was mentioned in some of the news reports that came out while the Colorado University group was working on this. As you know, the whole project fell apart, and in the end, a group of outsiders were called in to write the final report. The final report had nothing to do with the work that the group had actually done. It's a long story, and there was a very good book out called UFOs Yes, written by one of the participants, Dr. Saunders. That book, of course, is now very hard to find, but if you ever see a copy of it in a secondhand bookstore, you should pick it up.
Well, during your investigation, especially into the Point Pleasant area, you found a number of women that also had some mysterious pregnancies. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, this goes hand in hand with all of this. As the again, Bud Hopkins and his group are finding the same thing, and it's very hard to isolate and pinpoint this because many of these pregnancies are false pregnancies, what's called pseudocyesis. And I was totally baffled by the introduction of sex into these cases. As I traveled around the country in the 60s, I encountered many college students who claimed that they had not only been abducted by UFOs, but they had been forced into sexual acts by UFO occupants. And now this is still going on, but with certain variations from the 60s. There were quite a few cases of this. And there were a number of privately published books about this. People, this was, of course, a very sensational subject in the 60s, and no legitimate publisher wanted to touch it. So there were a number of privately published books on the subject.
Oh, how times change, huh?
Now, of course, it's sort of a ho-hum subject. And I didn't see the intruders telecast. I was in Minnesota this past week, and I was very busy there, and I had to miss those two telecasts. So I'll probably catch up with them. I'm sure they'll be repeated or they'll turn up on videotape or something.
Well, during this period of time, one of the investigators that I guess you at one point or another had worked with was Gray Barker, whom today unfortunately is no longer with us, but he was very well known back in the 60s with his investigations and books. What were his feelings on this, John? Did he ever come to any conclusion about this? I know you guys had talked on many occasions.
Gray Barker really didn't take it seriously at the end of his life. Gray, as you know, was also a hoaxer, and he enjoyed performing various hoaxes. He created a lot of false documents that are still circulated in the UFO field. And he at some point in the 50s, he ceased to take it seriously at all. And I wish I could tell you more about it. It was hard to get him to talk too much about it. We did have many long conversations, of course, about some of the peculiarities of these things. For example, we were concerned that witnesses would begin with what seemed to be a very real experience, and they seemed to be ordinary, honest people, and then they would start embellishing their stories. And we were concerned that people would suddenly, you know, go off the deep end like that.
Well, it sounds like a number of people today in the UFO field.
Yeah. I think when they get all that attention, they realize that in order to keep up the attention, they have to keep embellishing their story. And so they go and they do that.
Well, you know, one aspect of your book that I found fascinating, as a matter of fact, I just this past week, reread it, concerns the case of Woody Derenberger.
He's a very good example of that. Yeah.
Right. For many people that may not know who Woody Derenberger was, back in the mid to late 60s, achieved quite a bit of notoriety because of a series of contacts that he alleged happened between he and extraterrestrials, or what he called extraterrestrials. You investigated that case pretty thoroughly, didn't you, John?
Yes, and I watched Woody change as we went along. And Woody, of course, he came up with wilder and wilder stories. He was visiting other planets where everybody was nude, and walking around nude. And he would disappear for days at a time, and then he would reappear and say that he had been off visiting the planet Lanulus. It turned out, unfortunately, that he was married, and he had a girlfriend on the side. And so he was off visiting a girlfriend.
Did his wife ever figure that out?
Well, his wife sort of accepted all of his UFO stories, just as Jackie Gleason's wife accepted Jackie Gleason's UFO stories, you know. I don't know if you're familiar with Jackie Gleason's wife's book about...
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, he had a house in upstate New York, didn't he, that he called the Mothership?
I've seen it. It looks just like... When you first see it, it's a startling sight. It looks exactly like a UFO. And it must have cost him a fortune. Jackie Gleason also had one of the world's largest collections of books on the occult and on UFOs. And not only that, the poor man chose to die on June 24th. Which
is the same date as Frank Edwards, isn't it?
Well, Frank Edwards died on June 23rd. But so many ufologists seem to die on June 24th. Frank Scully, who wrote the very first UFO book, died on June 24th.
You know, of course, that's the date of the famous Kenneth Arnold sighting back in 1947 also.
Right. And it's a very significant date in ufology. And also in many religious miracles and so on take place on June 24th. You know about... the apparitions that are being seen in Yugoslavia.
Yes, I do.
Well, that all began on June 24th. So this June 24th thing is a very haunting figure. And poor Jackie Gleason.
Of course, you realize that's a month from today. Today is May 24th.
Yeah, today is May 24th. So it's started. But Jackie Gleason's interest in UFOs was very, very deep. And he often went on radio talk shows and talked for hours about it.
Well, what was the upshot after the reports of the Mothman started to come out when you were down there? Now, what many people may not realize is why this thing, whatever it was nicknamed Mothman. At that period of time, and I can recall it myself, there was a very campy and very popular television show on called Batman with Adam West, and of course a lot of his... nemesis were people like the Penguin, the Joker, and so forth, and somehow that title Mothman kind of stuck, didn't it?
A newspaper in Charleston, West Virginia, nicknamed it the Mothman. In Point Pleasant and the surrounding area, they called it the Bird, and it was known as the Bird, and a local rock group there even wrote a song called the Bird, but the newspapers always called it the Mothman. And that really stuck.
Has anyone ever been able to figure out what in the world it was?
No, we've never. I really worked very hard trying to get some kind of real evidence, like footprints or a photograph or some kind of or tangible evidence, and we couldn't come up with anything. And there were over 100 witnesses to this over a period of 13, 14 months. And all of these people seemed to be very straightforward and very honest people. Some of them were very prominent citizens in Point Pleasant.
Have there been any reports in the last 20 years about this thing?
Well, not in the West Virginia area, but there were in 1976, there were reports out of Texas, around Brownsville, Texas, where a group of school teachers saw something that they called a pterodactyl, which is, of course, an ancient flying creature. And Jerry Clark went down there and interviewed them. And there have been spotty reports from different parts of the country. Of course, after my book came out, I got a lot of mail from people who said they had seen things like this. I got a letter from an airline pilot who had seen one of these things flying at a high altitude from his airplane.
One of these creatures.
One of these creatures. And he wrote to me. So
I'll take a wager, though, that he didn't report it to the FAA.
Of course not. But, and then, you know, in the 1970s, there was, for a while, there was a group out of Denver called the Volunteer Flight Officers Network, in which all professional pilots who saw anything would report to them what they saw. And this was set up worldwide in the hopes that they would get some kind of real interesting reports. And actually, they were in existence for 7 or 8 years. And in all those years, they were able to explain away everything that they got. Most of them were rocket debris re-entering the atmosphere and things like that. And they only had like 6 reports that seemed to be real UFO-type reports. I know one came out of South Africa. It was very... pilots rarely see these things. You would think that pilots, since these things are flying, that pilots would see them all the time. They don't. They very rarely see them. And as you know, I learned to fly myself, and I know a lot of pilots, and pilots do not often see these things. When they do, they have humdingers of experiences. There's a man named Martin Caden, who's an old-time pilot, who's written a very good book called Ghosts of the Air, which is just accounts of pilots, what they have seen when they were, you know. And during World War II, there were a lot of extraordinary UFO sightings.
Well, you know, that entire region of the country over the last 15 to 20 years have had outbreaks of this type of activity, which is something that I found very unusual. For example, in the early to mid-1980s, the Hudson outbreaks of this type that I found very unusual. For example, in the early to mid-1980s, the Hudson Valley area of your state of New York was plagued by overflights of these huge objects, animal mutilations, abductions. As a matter of fact, J. Allen Hynek, who had been for 20 years the civilian consultant to the Air Force's Project Blue Book, was instrumental in writing a book about that series of sightings. Then we had the Wytheville, Virginia series of events that went on for a couple of years. And, of course, your case down in Point Pleasant. What is it about that section of the country, John, that seems to call these in?
You can go, like there's a little town, Hartshorne, Oklahoma, where the people would sit on their front porch and watch these things go by. Milledgeville, Georgia, people were seeing these things very frequently. Down in Florida, there are a lot of sightings in Florida.
Which, incidentally, are still ongoing right now.
Yes. There are so many sightings that I think it's one of the number of sightings sort of rules out the extraterrestrial idea. There are just too many sightings.
Okay, hold that thought. We've got to take a break and hear from one of our sponsors, and we'll be back in just a moment. Okay, we're back. John, you were saying about these various areas throughout the country that have these sightings. Actually, there are places like that all over the United States, aren't there? And incidentally,
all over the world, in fact. Now, you know, there's a big breakdown in news reporting. As you know, just recently, the United Press International went bankrupt, and I think has been picked up by a TV evangelist, purchased by a TV evangelist. The wire services are all dying. The newspaper business is in bad shape. And we're not getting the kind of reporting that we used to get.
Or the investigative reporting. You're listening to UFOs Tonight. My name is Don Ecker. My guest is Mr. John Keel, internationally renowned author and 14 and UFO investigator. If you'd like to...
You know, the Hudson Valley sightings were not new in the 80s. They were going on in the 60s. To such an extent that for a while there was a little magazine being published in the Hudson Valley with monthly reports of UFOs. And I used to know the fellow who ran it, but I can't think of his name now. But those sightings in New York State have been going on for a very long time. We had a lot of crop circles in the 60s, and nobody paid any attention to them then. And then I believe in my Mothman book I mentioned one or two of them. But we had so many other things to occupy us that we didn't pay much attention to the crop circles. Now the crop circles are a major topic, as you know. And in the last couple of years, there have been several books and There are quite a few lecturers going around the country, going around the world, talking about them.
Well, I just spoke to the publisher of Quest magazine, which now is called UFO, out of Great Britain, earlier today, and he was talking about the crop circles that are once again, of course, cropping up over there.
They have some new ones already?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's been something that many people have tried somehow to attribute to the UFO phenomenon, but the fact is that there have been very few sightings seen when these things happen. Do you have any ideas or theories on that?
No, I wish I did have. It seems, you know, there are people who try to say it's some kind of meteorological phenomena, but that doesn't seem to make any sense either.
Well, especially with some of the intricate designs that have been found in these things.
Yes, none of it makes any sense at all.
Well, you know, John,
and we're just going to have to wait and see if somebody can come up with something better in the way of a theory.
Well, let me try this on you and get your opinion. About a year and a half ago, Dr. John Brandenburg was out here in California and stopped by, and we were talking about the crop circles that were developing over in the UK. And he said, you know, let's try an experiment. Do you have a microwave? And I said, yes, I do. So we went out front with a paper plate, cut a piece of sod out of the yard, took it back inside, put it in the microwave, turned it on for about 15 seconds, and that grass laid down in an almost perfect manner that have been attributed with these intricate crop circles that have come up over there. Now, is it possible that this could be the result of an experiment of some type of electromagnetic energy or something along that line? Because that, of course, is what is in a microwave.
Well, you mean our experiment?
Yes.
It would be very irresponsible to experiment with something like that.
Well, of course, but look at some of those intricate designs. It's almost comparable to a mechanical weaver weaving a design into a rug. I mean, some of these things were absolutely breathtaking. It was art. And I have a hard time believing that UFOs or, you know, some type of cosmic event could cause that.
Well, there was a man here in New York, a radio announcer, who unfortunately passed away just a few months ago, Bryce Bond, who claimed that when he was in England, he was standing in the middle of one of these when it formed, and he said that he felt a heavy pressure on him. He was unable to move, and he was quite frightened by it. While the circle was forming around him, he was not paralyzed. He was just so weak that he could not move, and it was like a heavy weight or something was on him.
It sounds electromagnetic.
He told the story many times, and, you know, I've known him for years, so I assume that it was a true story. But he was telling this story. This happened to him in the 80s when he was over in England, and before the crop circle thing became a sensation. So maybe there is something like that. You know, I had a thought, a stupid thought. When we first started using radar, you know, we bounced radar signals off the moon and
right,
off Venus and so on.
Uh-huh.
Now, suppose somebody else is bouncing radar signals off the Earth from far, far away, and that would cause these circles.
Well, that's, you know, that's as good as I think anybody's idea yet that they've come up with.
But if you were standing on the moon back in 1946, when our radar beam came down on the moon, maybe you would have felt like a heavy weight was pressing down on you, too.
Well, you consider yourself not only a writer, but a 14. How do you explain the term 14? What exactly do 14s do?
Well, there was a writer back in the 1920s named Charles Fort who wrote four books about all of these things. He sort of discovered flying saucers by going through old newspapers from the 1800s. And he wrote four interesting books covering all of the things that science either overlooked or couldn't explain.
So therefore dismissed, I might add.
Yes. And so UFOs are just one of 2,000 subjects that are considered 14 subjects. You know, some of them are frogs falling from the sky and things like that. But there are many, many subjects, each one fascinating in itself. Loch Ness monsters and Bigfoot and the abominable snowman, all of these are 14 subjects. And unfortunately, very few people try to study all of these subjects. They usually just pick out one subject, study that, and ignore all the rest. In fact, the people who are trying to catch the Loch Ness Monster just dismiss UFOs, as the UFO people dismiss the Loch Ness Monster.
But yet they all have quite a bit of similarity, don't they?
There are certain things that are similar, yes. Certain characteristics and patterns.
Okay, I want to let the listeners know that I told them earlier in the show to make sure that they got their hands on a pencil and a piece of paper. R. Beck. John, how many books have you written in your career?
Well, I've written quite a few books under other names and all. I've written books on electronics and on magic and things like that. I've written about 30 books.
30 books. And the Lord alone knows how many magazine articles.
Well, there's no way of counting those. Yeah, there. You know, I've been writing since I was a teenager, so I've written thousands of articles and stories. There was a period when I wrote a lot of short stories and sold them. So it involves many millions of words.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that we're ever going to get to the bottom of this mystery? Because I think it's a universally worldwide mystery. Do you think anybody will ever crack it?
No. I think it keeps compounding itself. Just when we think we're on the verge of solving one part of it, a whole new thing comes up, like the crop circles with the mysterious designs, the animal mutilations, and they chose, you know, there were many variations on those animal mutilations. There were also some people mutilations that didn't get any publicity at all. The local police preferred to sit on those.
I know I was involved in some investigations, I think you'll probably recall, a number of years ago that had that aspect to it.
So, no matter what we try to, how we try to handle this, it's always one step ahead of us.
Well,
we're dealing with a much larger phenomenon than just an extraterrestrial group.
Don't you think that it's true that all these things have probably been with us as long as there have been people, but it seems like at various times certain aspects get more play than other aspects?
Oh, yes. Zoroaster got into religion 2,500 years ago because of the animal mutilations in Persia. And then he made contact with an entity called Mazda. And then he developed his theories about demons and angels.
That's not the fellow that designed the car, is it?
No. But it was one of the early religions. And it goes way back. Of course, you know, there are Hindu scriptures going way back on this.
Well, as a matter of fact, the Native Americans in this country had traditions and legends about an entity they referred to as the trickster. Do you think it's part of the same overall phenomenon?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, the Indians have many elaborate legends about... The Indians also had sacred places that they wouldn't go near because they believed that some special beings were living in these places and that these beings had a magic stick which they point at you and it would paralyze you. So the Indians stayed away from these. It was usually a plateau or a mountaintop.
That sounds uncomfortably close to some of the entities that that Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs and others have written about that had a some type of an object that they would point at someone and paralyze them.
Mm-hmm. So it's all, you know, we keep reinventing the wheel. We keep rediscovering things that men have known about for many, many generations.
Well, you made an observation several years ago when I did that interview with you that each generation of UFO investigators have to relearn what the previous generation knew. What do you think the reason is for that?
Because nobody is keeping a really good history of all this. If there were some really good histories of the UFO phenomenon, then people would just have to sit down and read one or two books, and they would know what's happened before. But instead, we've got what? Now we've got thousands of books, most of them really terrible, that you have to wade through. So each generation has to sort of start from scratch and relearn.
Well, you know, Dave Jacobs, who just recently released or published a new book called Secret Life, originally worked on his PhD dissertation on a history of UFO phenomena in America. That's basically, don't you think, a pretty good place to start?
No, because he only covered one tiny aspect of it. It was mostly about Donald Kehoe's battles with the U.S. Air Force, which was quite irrelevant, really. The man who started it all was a man named Ray Palmer. And he for 20 years, Ray Palmer dominated the UFO field. And Ray Palmer is barely even mentioned in Jacob's book.
Yeah, I would think that most people today in the 90s would probably be hard-pressed to tell you who Ray Palmer was.
Right, and Ray Palmer was a very significant figure in the beginning. And now he's completely forgotten. So somebody should do a really objective history of all this.
Well, it's kind of like also Jim and Carl Lorenzen, who were probably the first civilian UFO research group, which started back in the early 50s, and now that they're both no longer with us and their organization is defunct, very few people are aware of APRO.
Right, and APRO did some very good work. They did some very they brought to light a lot of interesting cases. They published a number of amnesia cases and cases that were frowned upon by NICAP and the other groups in those days. They did a lot, and they also printed a lot of the South American cases, which were almost taboo in those days.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, we've got a treat for you because we, even though we don't talk about a lot of ancient history each week, we do have something called the UFO Magazine News Update, which we talk about what's currently happening in the field. So if somebody wants to do a history on this, this is a good place to get some information. Hang on, we're going to hear that from Vicki Cooper, and we'll be right back.
Hello, this is Vicki Cooper with the UFO Magazine News Update for Sunday, May 24th, 1992. The current issue of Time Magazine confirms our suspicions. The new hypersonic spy plane called the Aurora is indeed the culprit behind all those sonic booms and rumbles in California. Flying at speeds exceeding 4,000 miles per hour, the plane apparently caught the attention of British radar technicians in Scotland, who perhaps were quick to inform the media. Naturally, our Air Force isn't saying a word. Speaking of the Brits, UFO researcher Mark Birdsall of Leeds, England, reports the completion of his 400-page manuscript on Nazi flying saucer projects. During Hitler's reign of horror in the 1930s, German scientists were serious about developing an entirely new airborne weapon. Drawing on reams of documentation and other evidence, Birdsall has established to his own satisfaction that not only did the Nazis develop a working prototype of a disc-shaped craft, but that after the war, top Nazi scientists were secretly brought to the United States. One version of that human transfer, called Project Paperclip, of course has long been established, but Birdsall says the Yanks tapped the Nazi brain trust twice. UFO Magazine will be reviewing Birdsall's book, which is expected to be published within the next few months. Last Sunday, our UFO News Update described a 1989 experiment by two Japanese scientists. The experiment was considered a possible breakthrough in anti-gravity. But according to Dr. Robert Park of the American Physical Society, follow-up experiments by American scientists failed to duplicate those first promising results. In effect, the door is closed on the anti-gravity option, at least from that side of the science world. This news update is brought to you by UFO Magazine. We can be reached at P.O. Box 1053, Sunland, California, 91041. Or call us at 818-951-1250. That's it for now. This is Vicki Cooper for UFO Magazine and UFOs Tonight on Cable Radio Network.
And that's some recent history. And incidentally, one more time before we end the show this evening, on June the 14th, we're going to be having a drawing and we're going to have some really great stuff that we're going to be sending out to you. If you're interested in participating, spend 19 cents, send me a postcard to CRN. John, in the last few minutes before we have to sign off tonight, do you have any words of wisdom that you want to share?
Words of wisdom? Well, no. We're just waiting for to see what's going to happen next.
Well, you're the guy that told me it was snowing in Vermont tonight.
Yes, snowing in Vermont tonight on May 24th. And the temperature here dropped 37 degrees in about 4 hours. So the weather is still crazy here. And we're not getting any interesting UFO reports lately. Are you getting anything from in the States?
As a matter of fact, yeah, we are. We've had a number of just absolutely mind-boggling reports that have been coming out of Puerto Rico. Just about a week and a half ago, Bruce McAbee was out here and had some videos from Gulf Breeze, Florida, which there's still a myriad of sightings going on down there. And, of course, we have those perennial favorites back on the East Coast. Pennsylvania is still going through a ton of sightings and even creature reports. So I guess the phenomenon is alive and well.
Yeah, there's one section of Pennsylvania where it never stops. But Puerto Rico, you know, was where everything started in 1973. And then we had a big explosion later on in the rest of the country.
Yeah.
It all began in Puerto Rico in the fall of 73.
Well, you know, one of the really fascinating reports out of Puerto Rico, and of course this has been around a while now, but there were quite a few witnesses that alleged that they witnessed two F-14 jet aircraft, naval aircraft, that were absorbed into a huge UFO down there. About, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was a year or so back, perhaps 2 years. Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that was something. Of course, there's no way of telling, you know, from the Navy if something like that actually happened. They certainly wouldn't admit to it if it was.
Well, I mentioned in one of my Fate columns about some World War II cases of airplanes disappearing into clouds and so on. And I got quite a few interesting letters from veterans from World War II who had seen things like that or had been connected with cases like that, and we didn't hear about them at the time, so they do tend to sit on those things.
Well, it's amazing how in times of conflict the skies seem to just fill up with these unidentified objects. As recently as the Desert Storm business a year ago, there were reports coming out that there were UFOs seen flying around the vicinity of Baghdad and other areas. They seem drawn to areas of human conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. And it never ends. It goes on generation after generation. And as I say, I don't see any hope of really resolving it. It just is going to keep going.
Well, it's one of the things, John, that make it so interesting. We like to hang around to see what's going to happen next.
Well, certainly, we're probably going to have some interesting things this year or next. Strange things in the sky.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you get around to any of the conferences or anything, I hope we have a chance to bump into you. And incidentally, for you folks, one more time, I want to tell you how you can find out where to get John Keel's re-released issue of The Mothman Prophecies, a book that occupies a place of honor in my bookshelf. Just about out of time, I want to thank you for being willing to stay up this evening and come on the program. It's been a great pleasure. I greatly respect your work, and I want to have you back on again if that's okay with you.
Oh, thank you, and we'll run into you sooner or later, I'm sure, at some conference.
Okay, you take care, John. This is Don Ecker on the Cable Radio Network. The program is UFOs Tonight. Next week, my guest is going to be Mr. Bud Hopkins. And the week after that, we're going to have Linda Howe on. So remember, keep your eyes to the skies. You can catch us here on CRN, and we'll see you next week.
Baby, take my hand, don't be afraid.